Baby Pictures Famous Dictators Podcast, Episode 8. With me today is Emily XR Pan, editor-in-chief of Bodega Magazine, marketing strategist at Penguin, works in children's books, fiction writer and Game of Thrones superfan. Emily, thanks for being here today.
Thank you for having me.
We're going to talk about Game of Thrones, books and show, maybe a little skewed towards the show that premiered this past weekend on Sunday. Did you watch?
Of course I watched.
How many times?
Well, I watched, I would say 1.5 times because I was short on time, but I wanted to get in another viewing for this discussion.
I appreciate it. We got 10 questions, 10 points. It's probably going to branch out from there, but we're going to try to stick to the rough itinerary we have now. So for anyone, say, the 3 or 4 people who are listening to this right now that don't know what Game of Thrones is, do you want to give a quick summation of it?
So Game of Thrones is an HBO show that is based on the epic fantasy series A Song of Ice and Fire by George R.R. Martin. It takes place on the continents of Westeros and Essos, and it is, I guess, loosely inspired by the Wars of the Roses, with, you know, the Lannisters versus the Starks being based on the Lancasters versus the Yorks. So basically everybody across this land is fighting to claim the Iron Throne. There are all these various contenders and everybody's...
7 kingdoms, correct?
Yeah.
That's just in Westeros, though.
Yes, right. Just in Westeros. Everybody is fighting for the person they believe to be the rightful ruler.
Good summation. So what initially drew you to the series? Did you learn about it from the show? Did you know about beforehand? And what do you think, if someone was wanting to get into it, you would recommend going to first?
I'll answer the...
That's a multi-tier question. Sorry.
I'll answer the last part first.
Sure. Do it in reverse order.
I really, really strongly believe that you should start with the books.
Right.
If possible. I really think it's just like a marathon deal. You just sit down and pound through the books that are out right now. I think they're so amazing.
There's 5 of the... Wait, yeah. 4 of the 6? 5 of the 7? I don't know how it works.
5 of the potential 8
he's
hinted at. But I kind of feel like we've got a bit of a Robert Jordan situation going on. I think it
may never get finished, and some person's going to have to posthumously finish it.
Well, maybe. But, I mean, actually, George R. R. Martin has, I think, said publicly, otherwise it got leaked, but he said that in the event of his death, the HBO guys know how the story ends.
Okay.
So they know...
That's important.
They know how to wrap things up. But, like, I think the problem is actually that the books might just go on. Like, we might be looking at, like, 20 books here. I don't know.
Oh, no.
I don't know if he would live that long, but, like...
Certainly not. What is he, 60-something years old?
I don't even remember. He is pretty old.
We'll get the stat guy on that.
But, yeah, I feel like Game of Thrones, the TV show, is kind of like the diet version of the books. It feels very light in comparison, and I really, really strongly believe that you should approach the books first. But maybe,
as the form sort of necessitates, though. I mean, if it was delving into all the things, although, as we were going to get into later, the third season is split up, one book split up into 2 seasons, so it might be you get more, there's more breath for them to operate.
Yeah. So I actually first discovered Game of Thrones because I was this nerdy high schooler who was really, really into fantasy, and I was sitting on the bus, probably reading...
Oh, so you were first wave. You were before all the blow-up. You were in on the ground floor.
For the first book, I waited a while to read books 2 and 3.
Didn't catch your eye at first?
No, I got into it, but it was just, like, such a commitment.
They're big books.
They are big books, and they get longer and longer. And
which is saying something for the first book that is 850 pages long.
Yeah, and the most recent 2 books he had to cut in half. They started out as one book, but so I was sitting on the bus and I was reading. I think I was rereading Lord of the Rings for like probably the 60th time.
Sure.
And this guy who was sitting across from me turned to me and was like, "Yeah, that's nothing. That's like ancient fantasy stuff. That's not even, like, what good fantasy is. And I was like, what are you talking
about? A purist?
I was like, you can't judge Lord of the Rings. Nobody who calls himself a fantasy reader can judge Lord of the Rings. And he kind of went on and on about how he was reading real fantasy novels. And he holds up this tome, this, like, paperback tome that's all destroyed and has clearly been read a million times and is, like, taped together, and he's like, this is a real fantasy book, you wouldn't like it. And I was like, why wouldn't I like it? And he was like, well, it has rape and it has incest and it's very terribly violent. And he was, like, enjoying spitting these words out at me, and I was like, actually, that sounds totally like my type of book. Like, I'm into those really dark things. I'm all about the incest. So.
that's a good quote. Put that on your tombstone. I'm all about the incest.
Yeah, well, I was like, I would totally read a book like that. So I went to the bookstore and bought the book kind of just to prove him wrong. But I didn't read it for, like, probably 4 years or so. And then, yeah, I really liked the first book. And I guess it took me a while to sort of go back and pick up books 2 and 3. And I think by that point there was already buzz about the show happening, and then I was like, well, I have to speed through everything.
I actually had a similar experience of someone pushing the book onto me. When I was abroad, I was visiting my friend in London, and I was staying in a hostel with a large Norwegian fellow who I was reading when he came in, and I was staying there for three days, and he was reading Wheel of Time and Game of Thrones, and he was pushing them on me. So I was like, oh, I'm going to go buy them. So when I went back to Italy, I bought them in English, and then I didn't have space for them in my... So, like, because they were so large. I only had the one book, but it was so large, so I just left them in the common area of Villa Natalia in Florence. So maybe someone picked it up and actually read it.
But maybe you converted somebody.
Maybe, hopefully. You know, that's how books work. That's the beauty of literature.
Yeah.
The connection. So those are your draws. The show, maybe. Maybe we talk about the show. What do you think is a draw of the show? We're gonna transition a little bit here.
Okay.
Why it's become such a phenomenon.
Well, I kind of feel like Harry Potter is like the beginning.
The bridge.
I feel like...
You don't think the Lord of the Rings movies are.
I think that Harry Potter, the books, paved the way for things like Twilight and Lord of the Rings to blow up. I don't think Twilight would have happened if not for Harry Potter.
That's probably correct.
Symptom of Harry Potter. But right. I think that Lord of the Rings being given all that attention and being able to develop
a confluence of those two groups, maybe, and the Harry Potter sort of consumer base growing up, maybe.
Yeah. And, like, yeah, I mean, like, our generation is the generation that grew up with Harry.
Right.
And so I definitely think that, you know, those books and those movies sort of opened up these doors that allowed us to start exploring new things, because
the corporate executives are seeing all that.
Yeah, they're seeing twiddling. How the money can come in. I also think that Lost is, like, another example of this happening. You know, everybody, I think, expected it to be just this sci-fi cult favorite, and instead it blew up into this phenomenon that kind of, like, I don't know, maybe it's hipster of me to say, but I kind of was disgruntled at how popular it got. I wanted it to stay that, like, cult favorite.
Lost or Game of Thrones? I mean, this is the thing we're also going to talk about. Like, do you think there's a particular characteristic of these things? Like, I mean, are they sullied now?
That they're so commercial and everybody, like, walks around talking about it like they have breathed fantasy their whole lives, like I actually have.
I love that. I love the purest.
Not to bring out the score or anything.
It's like going to a punk show with an actual punk. They're very angry.
Yeah.
Very angry.
I do feel like that a little bit. But at the same time, maybe this is a symptom of being like a major female shopper, but I love that there is so much merchandise out for Game of Thrones. I love that, you know, I have, like, my Night's Watch mug. I have, like, you know,
you have your Ned Stark action figure.
I have my canvas map. I have my print. You know, I'm, like, determined to collect all the banners, right. And, like, none of this would be possible. Maybe people on Etsy would start making stuff,
right?
Without the show being big, but, like, none of this would be so huge without the power of HBO and this huge viewership. So I think there are pros and cons to
it. Yeah, there's windfall benefits. Yeah. You got to take the good with the bad, I suppose. But if maybe it's just a balance of good and bad. But you have to think of what the author, George R.R. Martin, has to feel like when he was at Comic-Con, when there was 12 guys with comic books in the boxes, and now it's 120,000 weirdos going around.
Well, he said that he posted once on his blog. It was a very, very funny post. He said that, I think when he gave one of his first readings, he, went into the bookstore, and he was competing with, a costumed character of Clifford, the big red dog. And everybody was drawn over to Clifford.
As they should be.
And everybody ignored him. And I think when he gave his reading, the two people who were sitting at the cafe got up and left. So he ended up giving the reading just to the booksellers. And now, he I went to see him at Union Square. There were 2,000 people there.
Sure.
Insane. I got there. So this was for a reading that started at 7 o'clock. And
you got there at 7 o'clock the day before.
I should have.
Was there camping out involved?
I had work. Otherwise, I probably would have been one of the crazy ones who got there in the morning. But people apparently started lining up at 6 in the morning.
Sure.
It was crazy. And when I got there, half the seats were full.
And people say literature is dead. People say no one reads anymore.
And the entire time, everybody was cracking jokes. Everybody was wearing their Khaleesi shirts, their Night's Watch shirts. When he walked through, everybody was like, "The King of the North! The King of the North!" and there were people who walked up to the microphone and they were like, "Just one question. Hodor, Hodor, Hodor?"
This is all normal stuff. Super normal.
It was amazing. I'd never seen anything like it.
It must be amazing for him, thinking back to the reading where he's reading to the people that own the bookstore.
Right? And, he's talked himself about, how there are major pros and cons to this. He misses being able to go to a convention and not hide from the fans.
Right.
And have conversations and FaceTime with people. And now he has to kind of, huddle in his corner and hope that people don't see him, because then it'll just be a stampede.
Correct. Also, good with the bad. that's what big money does. It'll find, it'll just eat out the heart of anything, but I guess you can't eat it all. There's always some left.
Yeah.
So back to the show. Having read all the books now, I'll give a disclaimer that I've only gotten a certain ways into the first one, so you're going to have more perspective on this than I will. But having read the books, do you feel as though Weiss and Benisoff, am I saying that right?
I don't know.
The people that adapted the show for HBO? Weiss and Benisoff, we're calling them that. They can tweet at us if they want to get disgruntled. Do you think they've handled the adaptation well? What omissions do you feel are most egregious? Which ones do you actually think maybe aid the narrative? Or do you think any aid the narrative?
It's interesting because, there's so much... There are so many, small details that figure into a TV show. Like dumb things such as, is this character's name too close to that character's name?
Correct.
So, they changed Asha Greyjoy's name to Yara so that she wouldn't be confused with the wildling woman named Osha. But then Yara sounds like Arya. And, is that not confusing there? And,
I'm confused.
And also, I don't know. Changes like that bother me because they seem a little bit unnecessary, because I feel like all the characters are so confusing in the sheer volume.
By the fifth book, there's over 30 main characters, I believe.
Yeah.
30 POV characters.
There are hundreds and hundreds of characters that are just, their names drop here and there. So it's it's going to be confusing. Trust your viewer to catch on.
Give them some credit.
Yeah. So changes that's like that annoy
but they I've only read, I think, 250-300 pages of the first book, but they eliminate some of the children, I think, from the families, right? Or is that wrong? The Starks, I think, have a 3-year-old son. Is he in the show?
Rickon? Yeah.
Rickon. He's in the show?
Yeah.
Rickon is in the show.
Yeah, he's just a child. He doesn't have anything.
That's a blind spot in my memory. I was they left out Rickon.
Yeah. I guess he doesn't play that huge a part for a while either, because he's so young. But it's interesting, on the show, they inserted Talisa, the healer from Volantis, who Jon Snow Not Jon Snow. Sorry, Robb Stark falls in love with.
Right. And oh, she's not. She's not in the books.
She replaces a character named Jane Westerling in the books, and Jane Westerling is a very, very bland character. She's like almost of no interest. So when they brought in Talisa, I was at first kind of annoyed because I was like, you know, who is this woman? Why is she here? There never was a healer from Valenis. But now they've made her much more interesting than Jane Westerling. So I kind of like that change.
Way to go, guys.
Way to go. I don't like changes like how, like, Tyrion was introduced to us with a prostitute. That's the first thing we see of him in the show. But in the book, which you've probably met Tyrion at this point.
Right.
We see him through Jon Snow's perspective, and he's kind of like, provoking Jon Snow, and he's showing what I feel like is his genuine nature, and that was
the telling moment. Him how to be a bastard because he's a dwarf, right?
And like teaching him to grow a pair,
life lessons.
Yeah, and so in the books, I immediately took to Tyrion, but in the show, I was like, why do we have to see him with a prostitute first? You know, first impressions last. even though, I mean, he's all about the
ladies. Totally redeeded himself. He is all about the ladies. Give him that.
And then there are weird things like Daenerys' dragons were stolen on the show.
Oh, that's not in the book?
Doesn't happen in the book at all.
So all the Where Are My Dragons? For naught.
Yeah. And like most recently, you know, in the season premiere, we see Jon Snow convincing Mance Rayder why he should be allowed to join the Wildlings. And the answer he gives in the books is totally different. In the books, it's, well, I don't know if I'm allowed to spoil.
Keep going. Keep going.
So in the books, it's that Mance Rayder has been to Winterfell before in the guise of, like, I think a traveling bard or something. So he has seen Ned Stark's halls, and Jon Snow is like, well, when you went, did you see where I sat? He's like, I sat all the way at the back. I wasn't given a place with my father, even though I'm part of the family. You saw how people treated me. You saw, you know, how they spoke to me, and my status was so low. And I know that I can prove myself, basically, is his whole spiel.
Right.
You know, beyond the wall, the status of bastard means nothing. Snow, the last name, Snow, doesn't mean anything.
Yeah.
It's all about what you can prove and how strong a man you are. So, and I really loved that reason. So, like, when there are parts in the books that are really powerful that I've, like, practically memorized the moment, and then the show does it differently,
yes.
It's a little bit, it cracks my heart.
They do play down some of the, I guess, maybe emotionally ambiguous things, like Catelyn's mistreatment of Jon Snow is a little not as harsh as it is in the book, I feel. And then Sansa, how oblivious she is, like, not as present, I think, in the show. Because she's, like, pretty oblivious in the first book, at least what I've read so far.
Yeah,
but of being enamored with Joffrey,
like,
it's there, but they're not at the same levels. It's maybe, like, 9 in the book and
yeah.
6 in the show or 5.
Yeah. I think that is because the major challenge that they have between converting the book into the show is that the book puts you in the characters' heads. And you
Correct.
Jump from character to character, every chapter is a different perspective.
Third person close, as they call it in our
yeah.
in our racket.
And in the show, it's like you just see everything from a bird's eye view. Like they're not doing the
omniscient.
Cheesy, omniscient. They're not doing the cheesy soap opera device where you have a voiceover and you
yeah.
hear somebody's internal thoughts as they gaze.
The interiority of Jon Snow, I see.
Yeah. So that's probably their biggest weakness, and I think that's part of what makes the show feel so much lighter.
So the current season is an adaptation of the first half of the third book, A Storm of Swords.
Mm-hmm.
Prevailing consensus is, from what I've gathered on the internet, that this is the best book. Do you agree? And was it the best strategy to divide the book into two seasons?
So I love the first three books equally. I remember finishing the third book for the first time, and it was like a punch to the gut. It was so intense. It was phenomenal. And I feel like the books after that kind of, you know, fell off the side of the cliff.
this is you're talking about the fourth book?
Yeah, the fourth and the fifth book.
Oh. But that's also a common assessment, right?
I think that's a common assessment.
He could still sell out Union Square. It's fine. He's not going to get offended.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, definitely. But I mean, there are different problems with books 4 and 5. Like, they were supposed to be one book, and he split them up into two, and he split them up regionally. So you are separated from the characters you love by region, not by time or anything. And you have to sort of hold.
So there's one Westeros book and one Essos book?
Sort of. And they're just, he also, like, starts playing with other characters and pulling in other characters who you don't give a shit about. And you're just like, why am I reading?
What was Robb Stark's girlfriend's name? The bland one? Does she get her own
Jane
chapter?
Westerling.
Jane Westerling.
No, she doesn't. Oh my God.
Her name is even boring. It's very Stepford Wife.
It is very Stepford Wife.
Yes.
Yeah. So anyway, I felt like the first three books kind of all swirl together in my brain. They're just so good, and I can't ever just read one of them. I kind of always read all three of them together. It's a big investment of time, but I always do it. But what I think is interesting is apparently Storm of Swords was published overseas as two separate books.
Mm.
So it was called Steel and Snow and Blood and Gold. And that was when it first came out. So in the US, I think it was one book. And abroad, in certain countries, it got split into two books because it was the longest book he had written at the time.
So this was maybe more a marketing thing than his artistic vision, or?
Probably. I mean, isn't that what always happens? Like, J.R.R.
Right.
Tolkien wanted Lord of the Rings to be one book, and it was split into three against his wish.
That bastard George Lucas put out Star Wars, goes in 3 weeks later, and puts in Episode 4.
Yeah, so I feel like they probably felt like it was logical to split the show up following this division, but it's also, you know, of course, a strategy for lengthening the lifespan of the show, because, I mean, if it takes George R.R. Martin...
Exactly, it affords him more time to finish the book, yeah.
Like, what are we going to do when we catch up, you know?
I mean, it would be a huge problem if they caught up to the narrative in the book, and then it took 7 more years. By then, it'll fade out of public consciousness, the Twitter consciousness.
I feel like they probably would go ahead and finish the show.
Before he put the book out?
I feel like that's what they would do.
I don't know if anyone would allow that.
Basically given his blessing, right? Like,
the blessing,
I'm dead thing.
Yeah, but I think they would put the book out maybe beforehand. I don't know. We'll pull the contract up later. We'll do a reading of that.
But I think it's interesting to sort of compare this to the treatment of the Lord of the Rings movies and the Hobbit movies. Because, like, if you had asked me 15 years ago about a Lord of the Rings movie, I would have been like, oh, it would do so much better as a TV show. It needs more time to expand, blah, 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 blah.
Many corners got cut in those movies.
A lot got cut. A lot of characters got cut and plot points and great, wonderful things got cut. But I actually think that the Lord of the Rings, I prefer the Lord of the Rings films adaptations to the Game of Thrones adaptation.
Right.
Do
you wish to elaborate on that?
I just feel like I'm not sure what it is. Maybe it's because being that it's on HBO, there's so much gratuitous sex.
Yes.
And so many gratuitous scenes. I mean, there's plenty of sex in the book, and that doesn't bother me. But, you know, they add in, going back to what they changed in the show, they added in, like, scenes with the prostitutes that I felt were pretty unnecessary. Like, there's a scene with Littlefinger and two whores, and they're just...
Yes.
You know, it's purely for the HBO audience.
Correct. Well, there's a sense that they're having their cake and eating it, too. They're getting the moral ambiguity and the complexity of character and the depth you're going to get from prestige television, but they also have to apply to the wider swath of the viewer base with the sex and the violence that sort of characterizes action movies and such.
Yeah. And I kind of feel like it's almost tilted the show so that it's not, I don't know, it doesn't feel as dense or deep as the books do. Like, it feels like there's a layer underneath missing. Like, it's almost, I don't know, I can't quite put my finger on it, whereas I feel like Lord of the Rings did a really good job of capturing the whole feeling of it. So, like, right. even though there's so much missing, it still feels like if you were to look out across this land, that
across
Middle Earth really is endless. Like, that's how it feels. But the Game of Thrones show feels, people are probably going to hate me for saying this, it feels more like, you know, a piece of paper.
Yeah, oh no, there's certainly a flatness to it that the books don't have, or the books have a depth that there is a, it's flattened somewhat by the show, as it has to be, I think, if you're going to get into a certain time frame, you're sort of corralled into those 10 episodes, and you have to get as much as you can into those. And I feel, at least from the production point, maybe, I mean, to have the artistic side, but from a technical point of view, the way that they've captured the world, like, you can tell that every dollar of that budget gets spent on that show. Like, the acting is as good as it can possibly be. The set design is pretty great.
Daenerys' eyebrows bother me.
Daenerys' eyebrows. I mean, we could talk about
it. And Cersei's eyebrows, too. Like, you have so much
money. So we should write a letter to the makeup artist.
You can, like, dye the hair and everything, do these beautiful costumes, but their eyebrows do not match.
Their tweezers are obviously not made of Valyrian steel.
And I feel like, going back to the Lord of the Rings comparison, that, you know, when they initially announced that The Hobbit was going to be more than one film.
Why?
Initially, I was like, oh, maybe they'll actually cover everything. And then I went to see it, and I was like, this is terrible.
Mm.
This is, it's almost doing the same thing. It's just trying to make money. So there are these almost gratuitous filler scenes.
Yes.
You know, and there's a lot of, well, anyway, it's a, that's a whole nother story. But yeah, I feel like,
do you think these books could have worked as a movie? No.
Maybe multiple movies.
I believe what when he was originally approached to have it licensed, he their sort of fix-all was that, oh, we're going to have one character for this movie, one character for this movie. Like, we're going to follow Ned Stark.
Really? For, I didn't hear
that. And there would be, what, however many movies. But, I mean, what would there be, 50 movies?
So interesting.
Or maybe it would just be like the Starks, maybe, for the one movie, and then you go to the Lannisters.
Oh my god.
Which could have been fascinating, but almost impossible, I think, to pull off.
Yeah, I think it would be impossible.
To keep all that in your head, because then there would have to be simultaneous scenes where you're seeing it from the point of view of the... It didn't happen. Who cares? We're arguing a negative here. Do you have a favorite character? Has this sentiment been affected by said character's depiction in the show? Do you think that the construction of this narrative from so many points of view allows for a favorite character? Or does it dissuade you from having a favorite character?
I feel like, well, I love, love, love Jon Snow and Tyrion Lannister, and I also really love Jaime Lannister.
Ooh!
And
I like Jaime Lannister, too.
And I feel like the way he presents his story, it's not that it, like, dissuades you from having a favorite character. It's more that his characters are much more realistic, and they have flaws, and they are multifaceted,
right,
like actual human beings are. So you're just forced to love them for those flaws, and I kind of really, really dig that. You know, it's really hard to buy into a character who is fully evil or who is fully good. You know, like, Sauron is entirely unbelievable,
right,
as a character, and Aragorn is, like, way too good. Aragorn's only flaw in The Lord of the Rings, Aragorn's only flaw is that he is related. He is an heir of Isildur. He's related to Isildur, who was too weak and, and didn't have the honor.
Second order flaws.
Yeah, so
flaws passed down through the generations.
Other than that, Aragorn is like the picture of perfection.
Right.
He is the goody two shoes,
yes,
valedictorian. Well,
there's a much straighter moral dichotomy in The Lord of the Rings than there is in this Game of Thrones series. There's very,
and it's much more
very stark good and bad. Yes.
For that reason. So you can, there are times when you feel like you can relate to Cersei Lannister, and you can also relate to Ned Stark, and you can relate to Littlefinger, and you can relate to Tyrion.
Every character has a sort of exogenous force that is imposed upon them that they cannot remedy, and it sort of mires their whole existence in a way that it would otherwise be pretty bearable. Like, you have Jon Snow being the bastard, you have Ned Stark who has the bastard, you have Tyrion who's born the way he is, you have Jaime Lannister who's sort of the most regal figure and the one who would be king if there was anything else, but he is forced into the king's guard and he can't be king now by his father. And every character has one of these forces acting on them that is a sort of like real life, you know.
Yeah.
You only have so much to pay for rent in this.
Yeah, exactly. And also, like, the politics. I love the politics. It's just so real and incredibly well-crafted. So, I mean, that's getting away from the characters, but...
No, we could talk about the political angles of the show. Does the Night Watch represent the American military? Maybe. Nobody wants to be there. It's cold as fuck. The White Walkers... So favorite characters, you had Tyrion, you had...
Jon Snow.
I'm a big fan of Theon Greyjoy, because he can't catch a break. He's not a good guy, but I feel bad for him. He inspires empathy in me, I don't know why. Also, the actor who plays him on the show always looks like he needs a bath.
He does.
He always has mud on his face.
I feel like all of the Greyjoys always need a bath.
Maybe that's what it is. Maybe it's a genetic thing.
Yeah.
He's taken prisoner when he's 10. All his friends get stuck in the Iron Isles.
Ward, right. Of Ned Stark.
He doesn't get any play, though. Then his sister cons him into, like, having sex with her. That's horrible. We're thinking about you, Theon.
Well, it's more that... It's actually that he wants to have sex with her and she refuses. She just kind of seduces him so that he'll bend
power.
His will.
Power. The books are a bit about power. It's a theme in there. We're going to get into hypotheticals now. You're an orphan in Westeros. Which house would you most want to be adopted by? Which house would you least want to be adopted by?
I think this question is so hard.
Do you want to name the Seven Kingdoms first, or all the houses?
All the houses. I actually have them listed here.
No cheat sheet. Show your work.
The great houses are... I am totally cheating. That's okay, though.
You should have played that off like you were getting it. That would have been great radio.
House Arryn, Baratheon, Greyjoy, Lannister, Martell, Stark, Targaryen, Tully, and Tyrell. I feel like... So the ones that I find most interesting, I'll just, I guess, go through. I love the Starks. I love them.
But terrible climate.
Terrible climate. I was... I mean,
bad
I feel
infrastructure.
Like I have tropical blood, so I would not survive very well. And
thin skin.
And also, I don't know that I would do so well in an environment where everybody expected me to be so honorable all the time.
Plus, direwolf.
Yes.
That's a pro.
They're pretty.
You're a cat person?
Yeah.
Oh, no.
No, I'm a dog person.
Okay.
They're definitely a huge pro. But, I mean, dragons, come on.
Exactly.
I would.
You're anticipating my answer with that one.
Pretty badass to be related to the mother of dragons. Maybe one day be a mother of dragons.
Right.
Immune
to fire.
Yeah, immune to fire.
But all of your pull at the club, all these things has been cast out.
And everyone's dead. How
all your your family's dead. I mean, the brother is not a great guy. He's R.I.P.
Yeah, but I feel like there's a certain strength in.
Phonetically, Targaryen comes off the tongue great.
Yeah.
It sounds a lot better than Stark.
I kind of feel like I would maybe want to be adopted by House Lannister.
Why? Because they're wealthy? You'd go to all the best schools?
You know, be forced to develop your cunning, live kind of luxuriously.
Okay. You're selling me.
You know,
You can't control dragons, though.
You can't control dragons, but based on how things are at this point, the Lannisters are the closest to the Iron Throne. So, you know, the possibility of someday being royalty, or someday inheriting a throne, or maybe someday inheriting Casterly Rock. I don't know. I think it's very appealing.
There's a lot of potentials there. Okay.
I wouldn't want to be
the House Symbols.
Greyjoy. Yeah, the House Symbols.
That's the factor in as well. Sigil, correct. Ooh, great word.
You have to factor in that. I mean, like...
What are they? The fish? The Iron Islands?
That's Tully?
Tully.
Right?
I don't know.
Or is that Arryn? I always confuse them.
You got the stag.
Yeah.
You have the dire wolf.
You have the dire wolf. Dire wolf is pretty badass sigil.
That's a good one.
The three-headed dragon is too.
That'd be a good tattoo to get.
You see my three-headed dragon medallion over there?
Right. We'll put a picture of that on the link.
The department is going to document my apartment.
How can I not? It's a treasure trove in here.
Which I feel kind of lukewarm about the other houses.
You have no one you wouldn't want to be adopted by. You get adopted. You run away from home. That would be a great joy.
Too wet.
You're always muddy.
Yeah.
Poor Theon.
Too drab and too gloomy.
Always cheering up Theon.
Yeah, I wouldn't want to be House Aaron or Baratheon, I don't think. I don't know. They kind of just bore me.
I'd probably go Targaryen. You always have to help Daenerys find her dragons, which is annoying, I guess. But, you know, immune to fire is great.
Yeah.
Talking to the dragons is great.
Picking up language is very fast.
Yes. Fluent in Valyrian and Common Tongue, Dothraki. Yes, it's going to look great on their job resume.
Like, Daenerys...
Trilingual.
Like that, instantly.
Maybe, yeah. You know, she still had some plasticity in her brain. You know, after you turn 18, it becomes really hard to learn languages. Considering George R.R. Martin's advanced age and mammoth size, he's a large man who doesn't appear...
He kind of looks like Santa Claus.
He looks like if Santa sort of fell off the wagon maybe a little.
He also kind
of... Mrs. Claus dies and he gets a little dark.
It's so funny, he also talks in this, like, nasally, super nerdy voice.
Does
like,
he? That's refreshing to know. He should.
If I had met, like, high school aged George R. R. Martin, I would have been like, you are nerd supreme. You are.
As he now is.
Yeah.
At least he owned it. He's owning it so hard.
Yeah, he really is.
Considering all of that, his maybe poor health, he's maybe gonna die before Song of Ice and Fire series is over. Hypothetical. In the event of his death, his estate contacts you to finish writing the series. What plot point do you address first? I'm moot on this issue because I'm not as far in the books as you.
You could probably speculate based on the show.
I can maybe speculate.
So what I think is hilarious is that he's been creating all these reasons why Daenerys can't just go back to King's Landing.
They don't want to cross the Narrow Sea.
Yeah, and, like,
she loses the dragon.
In the books, there are 5 million other obstacles.
Sort of a waiting for Godot type undertaking by Daenerys.
Yeah, and, like, you know, oh, her dragons need to grow up. I mean, this is a fantasy novel. He could have the dragons instantly be humongous.
Right. There are no dragon growths.
And it's literally just that he's, like, putting off that plot point to give her something to do, I feel like, while everybody else is developing their little schemes and fighting out their wars and whatnot. So, I don't know. I'm kind of getting tired of that. And I think I would just bring Daenerys back to King's Landing immediately.
She's still not back? Spoilers?
Oh, oops. Do you want me to... oops.
Oh, no.
Spoiler.
That's not a spoiler because nothing has happened.
Yeah. I think I would ultimately put Jon Snow on the Iron Throne.
Would you now? Well, I think we might address that in the next question. But I think the only thing I wrote here is more Joffrey. I mean, everyone loves him. Play it
more
up.
More Joffrey. Oh, God, Joffrey. I want to give the direwolves a huge role. I want them to come back and be, like, major. Like, as major as the dragons.
Ooh.
I still am waiting for, like, Arya's direwolf to resurface. I'm convinced that
it's alive still. Wait, they kill hers and Sansa's, is that right?
No, they killed Sansa's and couldn't find Nymeria.
Kill the butcher boy instead.
They killed I think his name was Micah.
Micah.
Yeah. So yeah, I don't know. There's a lot to be done.
That's very true.
There's a lot to address. It'll never ever be fully addressed, I feel like.
Bring Daenerys back. We'll make the t-shirts. That'll be a hashtag. It'll trend during when the podcast airs. Who's Jon Snow's mother? Now, when Weiss and Benisoff sat down to pitch the show to Martin, apparently the thing he asked them, the end-all question that would convince him one way or another was, who is Jon Snow's mother? And they answered correctly, but they refused to make public what the answer was. Who do you believe it is? and what do you think Martin's motivations are? Because even in the however many pages I've read, they harp on it a couple of times, like 5 or 6 times, like, oh, the bastard son and his mother, but they never say who it is. So why?
Well, actually, Ned Stark has mentioned her by name. He's called her by name.
Well, Wyla.
Wyla. Yeah.
But I mean, that could be a lie.
It could be a lie, but we're talking about Ned Stark, who is like the most honorable.
Well, that's his one. That's his one dark part.
Maybe.
That's his darkness.
I don't know. It's really interesting. I initially thought that it was just like before the show or anything. And when I just read the book, I initially thought it was just, like, a point he was addressing to just put out there, and I felt like he was more focused on building Jon Snow and less focused on Ned's old history. You know, when I saw him at Union Square, I asked him, I was like, do you outline your books? And he said, no, I'm a gardener, not an architect.
Okay, he does one plant at a time.
So I felt like, I was like, okay, I don't think that Jon Snow's mother is, like, a seed that he planted. I thought it was just, like, you know, something that happened on the side that he just, like, addressed and flitted onward and then addressed again by having everybody think that Ned Stark had an affair with this lady or with that lady.
But you're saying it's a How I Met Your Mother type thing where he draws it out the whole time and then she walks in the door in the last scene, it's over.
Well, so I thought that it was not that significant the way he did it in the books. I was much more interested in, like, how Jon Snow, like, what Jon Snow made of himself, and not so much like, oh, how is his history going to turn him around. But the show has obviously put an emphasis on it, you know, like the whole
the books
I'll tell you later
don't bring that point up. I think Catelyn asked Ned Stark in one of the first chapters, and he's like, shut up, leave me alone about it. But I think it might actually be really important if it turns out that Jon Snow is not his son and it's his sister's son, which could be a total thing. If they share the same blood, he would still be a Stark. But we also know that the sister was, before she was murdered by the Targaryens, was raped by Rhaegar. Is that how you say his name?
Yeah.
Rhaegar Targaryen. So then Daenerys comes back with the dragons. The only other person that can control the dragons is Jon Snow, who has dragon blood in him.
That is very
Which would be a fascinating thing.
I like that theory.
Which would make for a great last book.
Yeah,
and if Jon Snow ends up on the Iron Throne,
I
hope. Copyright Carmen.
I think you might have something there. I think that's
only because it's so foregrounded and he never says, my son, he says the bastard a lot. He says, I share blood with him, but he never really, and then he sort of throws out Wyla a lot, but never elaborates on it. Whenever even Rob Baratheon, I think when they're riding the King's Landing, brings it up about Wyla and he cuts it off short because maybe his relationship never really went that far with her. And she's sort of this red herring that he makes everyone chase because it's actually his sister's son. We'll have another podcast about that, though. Oh, so now we're going to play a song.
Oh, yeah.
So we're gonna pause for a bit. We're going to come back, and we're going to play Emily on violin, me on guitar. We're going to do a rendition of the Game of Thrones theme song.
It'll be super geeky.
Horribly geeky.
It'll be amazing.
My future wife is going to love this. She's going to drag it up in, like, 2040. Like, you're horrible. Okay.